try not to have an identity crisis. We're talking Me, Myself, and I on the latest You're Saying It Wrong podcast. We'll tackle reflexive pronouns and get a little bit of a remedial grammar lesson. Who am I? Why am I here? You're Saying It Wrong. Find it at KMUW.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Joan Silber is the author of 9 works of fiction, including Improvement, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. Silber is known for her composite fiction, or novels that are linked stories. Her latest, Secrets of Happiness, is no exception. I recently spoke with Silber about her writing and the secrets of happiness. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. Secrets of Happiness is a novel. It's a collection of connected stories. And when I saw the cover for like the Australia, New Zealand, and Europe editions on your website, I thought the imagery of the people in the puzzle was very telling. So how would you describe this book?
Well, it's a form I've used for the last 5 books, and in some ways I think of them as a continuing project, even though the books are all quite different from each other. But I love this idea of starting with a situation, a premise that's disturbing. In this case, a family discovers that the father has had a whole other secret family. And then watching how that plays out in lots of different strands. I love the idea of lots of things going on at once, no one thing being the only story. It's just, that's been important to me.
And, you know, as I was reading, you know, we begin from Ethan's perspective, and then the next chapter is from Joe. And then I thought, okay, I know what you're doing. And then you offer us Maribel. And so I thought, okay, same lives, different lens, or is it the same life? So talk to me about perspective and what we see through this shifting perspective.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked that, because I think perspective is really the key sort of idea for me. My mother used to say, you're not the only pebble on the beach, which is, of course, not welcome news. But I want the idea that one view is not the whole view, that there's all these other things going on. So perspective is how I do it. And it's also, as a writer, I love that. I love having to shift to the person you didn't like so much or that you took no account of is the other story, and trying to emphasize how important those shifts are.
You know, we met a lot of characters in the book, but we only heard from the perspective of 6. How do you decide whose story to tell?
I would say trial and error is the short answer to that question. I thought the first chapter maybe was just going to be a story by itself. And then when I got more interested, I knew that I wanted to move to the Thai American family, that was next. And then his story, Joe's story, just led in other directions. But I often make wrong guesses, and then those are the things that get cut or not used. There's often one whole chapter that I've dreamed up that I decide I don't want to use. I mean, that's just the way of it for me.
Do those people still, do their stories still exist in your mind, even though they're not in the book?
Sort of, depends. Halfway, I'd say.
So there are several themes or connecting threads in this novel, you know, beyond the characters, and I want to talk a bit about them. And the first one, at least to me, and you can tell me if any of these were not themes, I won't be offended. but I thought it was interesting that money could play such an important role in a book titled Secrets of Happiness. You know, late in the book, in the chapter from Ethan's perspective, you wrote, people filing for divorce were always trying to collect, in the form of money, payment for what could never be paid. The suffering was real, the money was real, but the relation between the two was a delusion. Can you talk to me about how our relationship with money helped shape the book?
Oh, yes. And in fact, that little sentence you read came when I was young. I was like an errand person for a lawyer, and I saw exactly that. The people pursuing are suing for money in a divorce, and money is an exact, you know, money is a substitute. So I certainly wanted to get that. And I wanted to get, I thought I was going to work more closely with ideas of inheritance, which just come in a little bit, mostly in the Bud section. Someone refuses an inheritance. But I don't believe that money buys happiness. I hope that's clear in the book. But I think it's important. And in fact, the second chapter, with the Thai American family was published as a story under the name Love and Money, because I think those things are so often braided together. And certainly the father, who has brought this illegal, I mean, not legal wife, but sort of his wife from Thailand, believes that money can buy, he's more comfortable with money paying for things than otherwise. And I think a lot of people are that way. So the themes of money and what it gets and what it doesn't get are definitely, they play out in the book. And they're certainly connected to our notions of what makes us happy and what doesn't.
A friend of mine likes to ask booksellers and authors if there's an author whose work they've never read but would like to. And I could never give a firm answer, but after reading Secrets of Happiness, I think I have to say Dickens, because I don't know if it was a thread, but his work seemed to be peppered through the book. And can you talk to me about Dickens in the book, or maybe your relationship with Dickens?
I started the book in 2016 before the election, and my comfort after the election was reading Dickens. So I was reading Great Expectations, which is my favorite. But Dickens is always, of course, talking about money and happiness and you know, what the deprivation means. And I also thought that a lot of our current situations harken back to that. So when girlfriend of the one of the Thai brothers is deprived of her inheritance after a marriage, that's straight out of, I mean, I had made that up, and then I thought, oh, Dickens sort of that sort of thing way before me. So I wanted to keep invoking him. That was sort of important to me. And the other one who sneaks in is Robert Louis Stevenson, who was, because Treasure Island kind of features in the book. And I had, that was sort of, that's one of those nice accidents. I had the mother saying, when the father, who she doesn't know is cheating on her, comes home from his travels, she tends to chant, home is the hunter, home from the hill, and the sailor, home from the sea. And my mother used to chant, I mean, parents would chant, you know, bits of poems when I was growing up. And that's Robert Louis Stevenson. So when Treasure Island came in afterwards, which was a favorite, you know, book of mine and my brother's when I was growing up, we had a recording of it that we loved to listen to over and over, you know, so that also, that sense of how well that operates was important to me.
Well, and I think it was later in the book, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I only wrote down the page number. Was it Ethan who said, and wasn't it Treasure Island, a tale of how lust for treasure made people betray and sabotage and murder one another? Is that right?
Yes. They behave badly going for that treasure. Right?
So if I had read Dickens, would I have been more enriched with this novel? Do I need to read Dickens and then go back and reread Secrets of Happiness?
No, but you should read Dickens anyway. particularly Great Expectations, because it's his shortest and most, I think, you know, perfectly formed book. I still love that. And in fact, one great Dickens story I have is I was teaching right at 2017, right after the election, I was teaching for just a few weeks, for 3 weeks as a volunteer in Laos, in Luang Prabang, teaching English. And among the groups I was teaching were a bunch of teenage Buddhist monks. They were novice monks. And one of them, I was trying to give them assignments. They were learning to write essays, and actually they had pretty good English. And one of them wanted to write about a book he was reading. And I said, yeah, sure, write anything, you know. And it turns out he rewrote the first scene from Great Expectations, which is a prisoner hiding on a marsh and the little boy comes upon him. And I said, you're reading that? I'm reading that. That's so great. And in fact, the other kid in the class was sort of insulted and said, I do not know this book. anyway, I have my feelings about Dickens are all the more intense because of that incident.
And before we move on, do you have an author whose work you've never read but you would like to?
Oh, who am I behind on? many. I've never finished Proust. I've only done the first book and a half, so that's probably biggest on my list.
It seems that that death plays a big role in the book as well. Some deaths are sudden where others are expected, and I think most occur off the page. There was one line that I noted, and this was in Rachel's chapter, and it's about her brother Saul, who was dying. Saul was speaking from a spot further on, a better view, speaking with expertise. So talk to me about, you know, I don't know, either death in general throughout this book or perhaps the clarity that it provides to Saul.
The fact that he knows he's going to die makes him clearer. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, I think he just seemed more content, more happy.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I'm sort of unusual in that I always say I had a Victorian childhood because my father died when I was five, just of a heart attack, you know, sort of an ordinary thing to happen. But in an otherwise very middle-class protected childhood, I had this kind of early knowledge. So I think, you know, it's always in my work. It's always there as a thing that can happen to people. And of course, as I get older, friends grow ill or, you know, die around me. So not as many as some people have had, but it's certainly there. So it's going to enter the work. I would like to think it's clarifying, you know, rather than muddling. I would like to think that it makes people clearer to know that, you know, that life isn't infinite.
There are some other threads that tie a lot of these chapters and lives together, like things like the textile and garment industry, Buddhism and Asia. And I read in your bio that you like to travel as often as you can with a particular interest in Asia. Where did your interest in Buddhism and in Asia begin? And how much of Joan Silber is in all of your books?
I'm definitely in there, although I am none of the characters. You know, those things didn't really happen to me. But I'm in all of them. I would say I became interested in Buddhism when I was having various crises in my life, maybe 30 years ago. I became a kind of student of Buddhism rather than, I'm not a great meditator, I have to say, but the ideas of it were very important to me. And I would say the most important ones were, it won't last, nothing does. You know, don't worry, it won't last, nothing does. And get over yourself. Buddhism really does believe that most suffering comes from ego craving. And it's impossible for anybody to really absorb that fully, but it's still, it helps to know that. So I would say that those ideas sort of slip into my books, but I try to not have it, you know, heavy-handed or easily labeled and so forth. And in this book, Nadja, who's just in her early 20s, kind of gives her own, you know, hodgepodge version of those ideas. And I wanted to do it that way rather than have some sage, you know, emerge in the text. So it was my interest in Buddhism that first got me interested in going to Asia. I saw this trip advertised online. The trip didn't run, it was going to be a Buddhist trip that didn't run. But then I thought, oh, I could take a tour, which I'd never done before. I was, a sort of backpacky traveler. I found a British traveling, you know, tour company that went to China. And I was so thrilled the whole time that I thought, I can do this all the time. I can just sign up and go on these trips. So I began doing it once or twice a year. I started in 01 and have done it almost all the time since then. Sometimes I began to be able to do it on my own and not with groups after a while, but I certainly use groups. And of course, I didn't do it last year, so I miss it very badly.
When do you think you'll be able to again?
Well, I'm hoping in October. My friend and I are thinking maybe going to Singapore, which I think would be quite safe in October.
On the Counterpoint website, they posted a piece titled Five Questions with Joan Silber after they published your novel Improvement, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Fiction. And they asked about your most prized book possession. And in your answer, you said, quote, I always have trouble getting rid of books. They have sort of taken over my New York apartment. But this one seems more irreplaceable than the others. I was hoping you could share with us the story of that book.
Did I say it's story and verse for children?
Is yes, you did. Sorry, I should have said that.
That was the book. My mother had been a school teacher. She was a school teacher at various times growing up, but she had been an elementary school teacher before she was married. And I think this was a book left over from that. But it's, you know, an anthology of stories and verse for children. And I, you know, when I got old enough, I could read it myself. It wasn't in small type. And I loved it. When I go back and look at it, I still know a lot of those poems sort of by heart. You know, I could kind of sing along with them. So it was very important to me. It had lots of fairy tales in them. That there was one that was, I think, Rose Red and Snow White that I adored. You know, they were, children have a particular intensity in response to literature, I think. I do remember my mother saying, the house could burn down and you wouldn't know because you'd have your nose in the book. You know, why would you read any other way? I still think that, you know, when you want that transporting thing. So that, yes, and I'm glad that I still have the book too. It's quite precious to me.
Well, the books seem to be taking over my home as well. And so this is more of a curiosity. Do you write in your books?
Oh, no, I usually don't. And in fact, I did when I was young, I would write my name in them when I acquired them. And I don't even do that now. No, I don't. I'm afraid of defacing them, you know. And I do read a lot online now. I've cut back a little by reading online.
Now, we have talked about a lot about the book, and we've left quite a bit out just so people can enjoy it for themselves. But is there anything you want to talk about that I haven't asked?
Let me think what's left out. One thing that I also like to do that I do a little bit in this book is move through long periods of time. So there's one story, the Bud story. He's sort of a favorite character of mine because he's kind of a bad boy who has interesting, you know, an interesting life to him. He starts out with very right-wing parents and then goes on and does all sorts of quite different other things and winds up in Cambodia, which I love. But the movement through time is also important to me in the sense of long time passing as a quality of some of the work.
Well, and I was going to ask you about the one book that you have written that's not fiction, but it's about writing fiction, and it's The Art of Time and Fiction. Talk to me a little bit about that. Did it come out of your classroom because you teach, is that right?
Yes, it did come out of my teaching. I'm very happy that that's preserved because I put so much energy, you know, I taught for so many decades and that it's in some form. Charles Baxter, who's a dear friend, was editing this series, The Art of, and commissioning various people to write these books. And I knew that time was the topic I wanted to write about. I had given one class on long times in fiction, and I wanted to then sort of investigate how it worked in other times. And what I really did was go through, you know, favorite works and kind of figure out how they did it. You know, like, how does Chekhov skip over, you know, these big spans in times? What's his secret? And I had a wonderful time writing it. It was actually, you know, important to me to do that. And it's still, I mean, it's a while ago that I wrote it, and it's still very much around. So I'm glad for that.
Well, so what's next for you?
Well, I'm starting again on another. I feel like the what started out as things that were called link stories now really are novels. So I, you know, the form is getting more unified as I work with it, and I'm starting out on another form of that, I hope. And the first chapter, which I think I've done, involves someone who has great regrets over a friend he didn't stand by when they were both young and were doing hard drugs together in their teens or in their 20s. So that's the beginning, and I'm now on the second chapter of it. And that's all I know so far. I make them up as I go along. That's the other question people ask. I make them up as I go along.
That's so much fun. That was Joan Silber, author of the novel Secrets of Happiness, which was published by Counterpoint Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Be sure to join us in 1 week for my conversation with John Green about his book of essays, The Anthropocene Reviewed. And if you enjoyed this podcast, please leave us one of those reviews. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torin Anderson. Our editors are Lou Ann Stevens and Haley Krausen. And I am the producer. This is Marginalia. And for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.